and also includes the first nine chapters of 1 Samuel. And so this will bring us to the end of the period of the judges, and whenever I can pick this study back up at some point, this will pick back up with the time of the kings. So we're going to finish up tonight. That's my goal anyways. Got about 31, 32 slides to go through, so I'm going to be moving kind of quickly tonight to try to get through all of those. But basically just want to give a look at all the different judges and their stories and what's said about them. Some of the judges, there's only one or two verses said, and that's that. Others, there's a whole story with it. And I'm not going to spend a whole lot of time on those stories, but there are a few things that we'll point out and look at because I feel they have some good application to us today. So let's just get right on into it. So last week we had an introduction to Judges, and we discussed how that second generation out of Egypt did really well. They had a lot of great success under Joshua's leadership, and the overall reason being because they all had a mind to do exactly what God said. There was just no question about it. They followed the Lord's commands and his desires to the T. And the only hiccup they had there was with Achan. And but that thankfully didn't cost them too dearly, as it were, as we saw that happened under Moses when the sons of Israel partook in large groups of disbelief. And so aside from that one instance, I mean, it was an unbelievable thing that we saw take place under the leadership of Joshua. But that second generation has now passed on, and Joshua's passed on. That second generation is starting to phase out. But we see that they started off really well after Joshua died. You know, instead of just doing whatever they wanted to do, they inquired of the Lord. So they went to the Lord and said, okay, you know, Joshua's dead. What do we do from here, Lord? And we see that mindset there, and that they sought the Lord's leadership. God was their king. God was their provider. And we're going to see at the end of Judges that it's a whole different ball game. What we see at the start of Judges going on, that they're inquiring of the Lord, Lord, what do you want us to do? And what we see taking place at the end of Judges is night and day difference. And so we'll see that by the end of this class here tonight. But we see the second generation had a lot of success, and they went to the Lord saying, okay, what do you want us to do? And so we saw through that Caleb kind of took leadership. God said that Judah was to take leadership, of course referring to the tribe of Judah, and out of that, Caleb was the one who kind of took up the helm there, as it were, began leading Israel. But eventually that second generation, they all died off, and the third generation was now were the adults who were kind of in control and running things. And it says that the Bible tells us, Judges tells us, that this third generation did not know the Lord. And so they weren't fully aware of all that God had done and the things that had happened to their forefathers in that first generation. And so they ran into all kinds of problems. They did not clear out Canaan as God has commanded. Therefore, they broke the covenant that God had made with them. And so we discussed that last week, or a couple weeks ago. I wasn't here last week. And but so God became angry with them, and he gave them over to this king whose name I won't even try to pronounce, this king of Mesopotamia. And that's where we left off. And so that now gets us into the first judge, which will be Othniel, which we'll look at him just a second. But we also talked about last week how the story of Judges is just a repetitive thing. Israel goes after false gods. God says, okay, have at it. And they end up being taken into captivity by another country or another kingdom. They're in servitude to that kingdom for some period of time until they just finally get tired of it and they cry out to God and, oh God, we're so sorry, we messed up. Save us. And God eventually delivers them through the hand of a judge. Then that judge dies, and Israel goes right back to the false idol worship again. And it's just the same cycle over and over and over and over and over. And so that's what we see here in Judges, and that's what we'll see tonight. All right, so Othniel was the first one, the first captivity, as it were, this first servitude. And problems, you can call it a number of things. I don't know if captivity is necessarily the right word, but Israel basically became under defeat by another kingdom, okay? Under Joshua, Israel was the one that ran shot. They took control of everything. They defeated everyone. God was with them. God was doing the battles for them. And but as they started turning to false gods, God said, okay, if that's what you want. And so we see then that Israel then starts suffering defeat, and they enter into various forms of servitude to these other kingdoms. And so right now they're under the servitude to this king of Mesopotamia. If I'm not mistaken, I believe they were in that for 8 years. And so finally Israel cries out to the Lord, and so God raises up Othniel to deliver him. Othniel is the younger brother of Caleb. And after they were in captivity to the king of Mesopotamia, they cried out, and so he raised up Othniel, who led Israel in war against Mesopotamia and delivered them from their servitude. And after that, Israel had 40 years of peace. And from there, we see that that Othniel died, and Israel again, and that's something you'll see frequently. If you go read through the book of Judges, as you see, the judge died, and again, Israel returned. The judge delivered, the judge died, and again. That word again is in there a lot. Now, like I said, it's that whole rinse, wash, and repeat deal. Or wash, rinse, and repeat, whatever it is. It's that same cycle. And we see it over and over and over. So again, Israel did evil in the sight of the Lord. And of course, that's referring to idol worship. And we have to keep that in mind as well. That what they were doing was just not messing up. It was not just your typical run-of-the-mill sin and things like that. What they were doing is they were walking away from God. This wasn't a situation where they were just, you know, struggling with the law and not keeping the law to the T, as it were. What they were doing is they were completely and utterly walking away from God and serving other gods, these false gods, these idols and statues and trees and things made of metal. That's what they were doing, and that's what happened every single time. And that is what led them into the judgment and punishment of God. And so we got to keep that in mind as well. So that's what happened here. We see that in Judges chapter 3, verse 12. And so then God delivers them into the hand of Moab for 18 years. interesting thing with Moab, you know, Moab was a descendant of who? Where did Moab come from? Where did the Moabites, who'd they come from? Do you remember? Was it Lot? Yeah, remember Lot? His daughters one night, both of his daughters decided to get him drunk. And they had relations with him. And this happened on two different occasions. A really messed up situation. Severely messed up situation. And so from Lot came Moab and came also Ben-Ami, which from come the Ammonites. Ammonites. And so, you know, we see these are two people who are now in the land of Canaan who are having problems for Israel, but this was the nephew of Abraham. And so we see this tie, you know, this connection here all back to Abraham, but yet there's a lot of conflict going on there. And so after 18 years of servitude to Moab, Israel again cries out to the Lord. The Lord listens. The Lord raised up Ehud. The Bible tells us that Ehud was a Benjamite and a left-handed man, and that the Moabite king Eglon was a very fat man. That's not my words. Judges 3, verse 17. Go read it for yourself. So he is apparently a very large man. And so Ehud made a two-edged sword, a cubit long. From what I've understood, a cubit back in those days was measured from the tip of a man's finger to his elbow. Okay, that was a cubit. So you can imagine a little dagger sword type thing this long, double-edged sword. And he says that he strapped it to the inside of his right thigh. And so Ehud comes before the king and he says, hey, I've got a secret message for you. And so they go up to what the Bible refers to as the king's cool roof chamber. And we'll talk about that in just a second. And so while in this chamber, Ehud pulls out his sword and buries it in Eglon's belly. And it says that the sword went all the way in, handle and all. That's how large this man was. And so he said he stabbed the king with it. And so Ehud left the sword in Eglon's body, locked the doors of the vestibule on this cool room up here on the roof, and escaped. Eglon's servants came and found the door locked, and well, they decided that the king must be relieving himself. Again, not my words. This is just the story of the Bible. It's great stories in there. And so after a long period of time, though, they said, okay, this is not usual. This is unnormal. And so they took a key, they unlocked the door, and that's when they find King Eglon dead. And while they were doing all this and trying to figure out what was going on with the king, well, Ehud had escaped. And he was already starting an attack by Israel against Moab. And after that, Israel was successful in this attack on Moab. They defeated Moab, and then they had peace for 80 years. All right, so something interesting I wanted to share with you. Don't know how accurate or true this is. One of my Bible professors at Faulkner shared this bit of info with us as a theory of how Ehud escaped, because it's a really interesting situation. So the king had this cool room that was up on the roof of his palace or whatever the case may have been. We also see that Ehud went into this room with the king to share his secret message. After he stabbed the king, the Bible says that Ehud went and locked the doors of the vestibule and he escaped. And so you can't help but wonder, well, how did this happen? How did Ehud lock the doors? He had no key that we know of. Now, the servants obviously had a key because the Bible says that they used a key to unlock the thing after they figured out, okay, this is taking way too long here. And so how did Ehud lock this door, seemingly from the inside, but yet escape? Well, my professor at Faulkner suggested that that up here, this is where the king used the restroom, okay? He was the king, he had his own private quarters, and it was up on the roof. And so he suggested that the green here is like the room itself, and within that would be some form of a restroom, okay? And so what we see here is that Ehud would have locked these doors here, but he's still inside, up on the roof in this room. Well, how'd he get out? Well, my professor suggests like that. He suggested that according to the architecture and the stuff that he studied and all this kind of mess, that up on this, there's this room on the roof, and that's where the king's restroom was. And, well, you kind of think of an outhouse-type situation, and it went down below. And so he suggested that Ehud may have escaped through the king's toilet into the room below where the servants would collect and clean and things of that nature, okay? I know that sounds disgusting and gross, but hey, it's a theory. I don't know. He explained this to us in class one day, and we were all just, you know, wow. That's an interesting story. But nonetheless, I figured I'd share it with you because you can't help but wonder, well, how did he do that? How did he lock the door, lock himself in, and then escape? Well, maybe that's how. So, I don't know. Interesting situation, interesting story nonetheless, in my opinion. All right, next up is Deborah and Barak. So we see that Ehud, after Ehud had this victory with Moab, Israel had 80 years of peace. After Ehud died, Israel again did evil in the sight of the Lord. And so the Lord sold them into the hand of Jabin, king of Canaan. And Israel was oppressed for 20 years. Israel cried out to the Lord, and he raised up the prophetess Deborah. Now, Deborah was a prophetess, and the Bible just simply tells us that there was a particular area, a particular tree she would sit under, and Israel would come to her for judgment purposes, judging purposes. You can go read it all on your own. I don't have time to read the whole book of Judges tonight. But so Israel would come to her for judgment. Now, Deborah received word from the Lord and contacted Barak to come carry it out. But Barak refused to go unless Deborah went with him. And so Deborah says, well, I'll go, but then nonetheless, you know, I will surely go with you. Nevertheless, the honor shall not be yours on the journey that you are about to take, for the Lord will sell Sisera into the hands of a woman. And so we see there that there were some issues going on with this. And we saw this all the way up into the days of Jesus. You know, the idea of a woman having some form of leadership was just, and hey, we still have that struggle here amongst ourselves, do we not? You know, women's rights and everything else is a big deal today. There's a lot of drive behind it all. And so we see here that even it was going on here. Deborah was a prophetess. The Lord worked through her. It happened. And so that's what was going on. And so Deborah agrees to go along, and in Judges chapter 5, they were successful in their mission there. And Deborah even gets a song about her and how she delivered Israel from the king of Canaan at that time. After Deborah does her thing and does her judging and delivers Israel, Israel has peace for 40 years. And again, Israel does evil in the sight of the Lord, and God delivers them into the hand of Midian for 7 years. Now, Midian heavily outnumbered Israel, as did their livestock, okay? And so what would happen is Israel would go and they would plant their gardens, they would plant their fields, and Midian would come moving right in, and they would camp against Israel and just turn their livestock loose on all Israel's lands, which would eat up and trample everything. So their cornfields, you know, vegetable gardens, whatever they had planted as their food and as their the thing that they were going to survive on. It says that Midian and the people and all their livestock would just come in and wipe it all out. And so it was causing a major problem for Israel in the fact that, well, it was destroying their food supply. And let's just face facts, that's a big deal. You know, one of my big fears is that a hurricane is going to come ripping through here one day and empty out our grocery stores and everybody's going to go insane. You know, I've always heard that an area can go 3 days without food. And all of a sudden you start running into chaos because everybody's food at home is gone and they go to the grocery stores and there's no food there and it's just mass chaos. And so you can imagine that Israel was having a lot of problems here, a lot of troubles. And the Bible tells us in Judges here that Israel was, quote, brought low. And so they began crying out to God, and here God raised up the judge Gideon. And so an angel of the Lord visits Gideon and informs him that that he's going to deliver Israel. And so Gideon prepares a sacrifice for the angel of the Lord, who accepts it. And so I want to talk about this just for a very split second, because we've talked a lot about in here over the course of the past several months of this angel of the Lord, this angel of Jehovah. And we've talked about how, it's my strong opinion and the opinion of many others, that this is in fact Jesus. And here's another example of why I say that, because this angel accepts a sacrifice. Folks, no other regular angel ever does that. Any other just typical angel besides this angel of the Lord, this angel of Jehovah, as he's usually called, if it was just some other angel, okay, and he wasn't specified as the angel of the Lord, and somebody came and fell down, this angel would say, don't do that. Don't worship me. But this angel of the Lord always accepted the worship. And here he accepted a sacrifice that Gideon made for him. And so I'm firmly convinced that this was some form of Jesus upon earth way prior to the cross. And he was, and you know, just his heavy involvement with Israel at that time. And so Gideon took, Judges chapter 6, verse 27, it says that Gideon took 10 men of his servants and did as the Lord had spoken to him. And because he was too afraid of his father's household and the men of the city to do it by day, he did it by night. The Lord had told him to go in and tear everything down. Go down, tear down all the altars, tear down this, tear down that. And so, but Gideon was scared. He's like, I can't go do this in broad daylight, man, they'll kill me. My father, man, he'll have a cow if I do this, because it's going to bring problems for him. And so Gideon has some fear here, but he goes and he does it by night. The next day they wake up and all these idols are torn down and lay down on the ground. And, well, who did this? And, of course, it comes out that Gideon did it. But the Bible tells us that the Spirit of the Lord comes upon Gideon and he moves to battle, yet he has doubts. And so, So Gideon asks for two signs. And the first sign, he says that he has this piece of fleece, like a piece of wool, and he lays it on the ground. And he says, God, if this is truly what you want me to do, if you're with me here, then I'm going to leave this thing on the ground overnight. When I wake up in the morning, if it has dew all over it, but the rest of the ground is dry, then I'll know you're with me. Sure enough, next morning, Gideon wakes up, wrings out a whole bowl full of water from this fleece, but the ground around is dry. But Gideon still doesn't believe. It's not enough for him. And so he asked for God to do just the opposite. All right, Lord, I'm going to do it again, but this time make the ground all covered with dew, but leave the fleece dry. Next morning he wakes up. That's the way it is. Fleece is dry as a bone, and the ground all around is covered in dew. And so Gideon then says, all right, God's clearly with me. And so Gideon starts out with 32,000 people, but God says, that's just too many. And so God goes through this series of things with him to weed out and funnel out the men who don't need to go. And by the time it's all said and done, Gideon's left with 300 men to go into war here with. Not a large crew, right? Any of you guys ready to go into a battle against the whole entire kingdom with 300 men? Yeah, not a very large crew. So Gideon arms his men, and you know, if it wasn't enough just to have 300 men, well, Gideon arms his men not with swords and knives and shields and chariots and all this, but with pitchers, clay pitchers, and trumpets. Who's ready to join Gideon now? And so they go in and they surround the camp of their enemy here. And the plan was that when Gideon gives a signal, they're all going to smash their jugs together, and you know, which would break them and make this loud sound. They're going to blow a trumpet and yell. And so they do this, but it works. The enemy wakes up in the middle of the night. They hear all this going on, and you know, they hear all this loud crashing sounds going on, these trumpets blowing, and they're confused and discombobulated, and they start killing one another. They're down there in their camp just killing each other, and by the time it's all said and done, they're all dead, and Gideon and his men are just standing there watching. And so we see again that, you know, the hand of the Lord was with Gideon, and that here the Lord was fought a battle for Gideon, with really Gideon and his men not having to do much of anything but stand around and watch. After this, Israel has 40 years of peace. From here, Gideon's son Abimelech then serves as a quasi-judge. And I say a quasi-judge because Abimelech never was appointed by God to be a judge. He just took it upon himself. Well, I'm Gideon's son, so I'm going to be your leader now. And he just kind of takes charge. But it doesn't go so well for Abimelech. And I'm not going to spend any time studying him there. But you can go read it for yourself. I think his story is all covered in a single chapter. Take you all 5 minutes or less to read it. But things just don't go well for Abimelech. And but nonetheless, he... Like I said last week, there's debate as to whether Abimelech should be considered a judge or not. Take it or leave it. It doesn't matter to me one way or the other. But nonetheless, he was somewhat involved in it. These are the handful of verses that discuss Issachar and Jair. These are two more judges, and this is all that Judges says about them. After Abimelech died, Tola, the son of Puah and the son of Dodo. Yeah. A man of Issachar arose to save Israel, and he lived in Shamir in the hill country of Ephraim. He judged Israel 23 years. Then he died and was buried in Shamir. After him, Jair, the Gileadite, arose and judged Israel 22 years. He had 30 sons who rode on 30 donkeys, and they had 30 cities in the land of Gilead that are called Havoth Jair to this day. And Jair died and was buried in Canaan. That's all we're told about those two judges. So after Jair dies, Israel again served foreign gods, and God gave them over to the Philistines and Ammon. And here's where we see Ammon come into play. So Moab, again, descendants of Lot, had Israel under their servitude. And now we see one of the other descendants of Lot, one of the other lines, giving Israel problem. Something else that's interesting, I think I got a little bit of time. I had a slide in here on this, but I had deleted it for time's sake, but I'm doing all right. You know, we look back at this, and so Ammon, if I'm not mistaken, if I got my geography and memory down right, Ammon was on the east side of the Jordan, okay? That's where they were. But God did not allow Israel to take over the land of the Ammonites. And the reason was because of Lot. God said that they were not supposed to do anything. Now, they gave Israel problems back then. We can go back into Deuteronomy when Moses was leading Israel, and they were coming up there. You remember the whole 40-year wandering thing took place. Moses started making his way, leading Israel into the land of Canaan there. And as they were working their way towards the Jordan, you remember they had some battles there on that side, on the east side of the Jordan, that Moses led. This is back before Moses died. And so they had battles with Sidon and the kingdom, king of Og, I think was one of the things, if I remember correctly. And well, Ammon was also there, the Ammonites. And Moses had asked for permission for Israel to pass through there. But the Ammonites wouldn't allow them to. They said, no, you can't pass through here. And so God told Ammon, the Ammonites, well, he told Moses, but he said, look, the Ammonites are to never have any part of you. They shall never be allowed to come into the house of God or anything. Now, God was not allowing them to take over. Okay, he basically pushed the border of what would be Israel up against Ammonite and said, that's as far as you're going to come. You know, don't bother the Ammonite people because of Lot. And so it's really interesting there how we see God sparing those people for the sake of Lot, for the sake of Abraham. You know, going back hundreds of years, not thousands of years ago, still sparing these people because of who they came from. Yet these same people were giving Israel problems. And so God was still, or God was using them actually to judge Israel at this time. And so after Jair died, they went into the hands of the Philistines and Ammon. And so the sons of Israel, Judges 10, verses 10 through 16, cried out to the Lord, saying, we have sinned against you, for indeed we have forsaken our God and have served the Baals. The Lord said to the sons of Israel, did I not deliver you from the Egyptians, the Amorites, the sons of Ammon, and the Philistines? Also, when the Sidonians, the Amalekites, and the Maonites oppressed you, you cried out to me, and I delivered you from their hands. Yet you have forsaken me and served other gods. Therefore, I will no longer deliver you. Tell you what, you go out and cry out to the gods which you have chosen. Let them deliver you in your time of distress. And so we see here God said, you know what? You want to follow those gods? Go for it. I'll let you. If you don't want to follow me, if you don't want to be me, the one who's clearly been taking care of you guys for centuries now, fine. Go do your thing. But don't come crying to me when it doesn't work. You know, I tell this to my children a lot. I see my children doing something and I'll say, don't come crying to me when you fall and break your arm. You know, it's like, if you want to take a risk, go for it. Be my guest, but don't come crying to me. I don't want to hear it. I've told you. You know, that's basically what's going on here. God's saying, all right, you want to follow those guys? Go for it. Have them deliver you. And so the sons of Israel said to the Lord, we have sinned. Do to us whatever seems good to you. Only please deliver us this day. And I find this statement here to be a remarkable one. So they put away their foreign gods from among them and served the Lord. And he, that's the Lord, could bear the misery of Israel no longer. And folks, I see a lot of myself as a father in that. All right? I have seen some parents who have had children who have gotten themselves in all kinds of mess. And their children just get down to the depths of problems and the parents just can't bear it. They can't bear that misery any longer, so they come to try to deliver their child. They come and try to help their child out of the problem. And that's what we see going on here. We so see the fatherhood of the Lord coming out in this situation. I mean, Israel has been flat out unfaithful to the Lord. Flat out. Totally turned their backs on him and served another one. And the Lord said, I just can't do it. You know, and so he comes to their rescue. It says that he could not bear the misery of Israel any longer. So I find that a really remarkable statement. Because to me, it gives some insight into the heart of God. Into the mind of God. And so I love that that verse there. All right, and so let's see. Where are we going here? Okay, so yeah. So they're in the depths of all these problems, and the Lord just can't take it anymore, so he raises up Jephthah. Jephthah was the son of Gilead, but he was the son of a harlot. And so he was not, they ran him out of the house. I guess as he got older, they just forced him out. And it was mostly his brothers, it seems, because the Bible tells us that he fled from his brothers. And so Israel is under the captivity here with Ammon. Now, you got to keep in mind, Ammon's on the east side of the Jordan. If you remember a few weeks ago, we talked about Ed the altar. Remember that altar there that there a conflict arose between the west side guys and the east side guys? All right, well, Gilead's over here on the east side. Or not Gilead. Yeah, Gilead's over here on the east side, okay? That's where Gilead come from. The Gileadites, all those guys, they were considered the tribe of Reuben, Gad, and that half-tribe of Manasseh that was over here on the east side. That's where Ammon was. This is where the problem was going on. All right? And so So they fled from his brothers, or Jephthah fled from his brothers, and so Israel's over here fighting against Ammon. And finally, the elders of Gilead, they come to Jephthah. After they had run this guy off, they come to him and say, "Hey, we need your help." And so they asked him to be his chief. Well, at first, Jephthah was like, "No, you guys ran me out. You're on your own. Now you want to come to me for help after you run me off?" And so they expressed their desire for his leadership, and he agrees to it. Note, though, that God did not appoint Jephthah as a judge. He was appointed as the elders of Gilead. However, something interesting we see here is that they called upon the Lord. So they went to Jephthah and asked him to lead, but they sought the Lord out on their decision. We see that in verses 10 and 11 here of this particular chapter. It says, "The Lord is witness between us." This is the elders talking to Jephthah. "The Lord is witness between us. Surely we will do as you have said." Then Jephthah went with the elders of Gilead, and the people made him head and chief over them. And Jephthah spoke all the words before the Lord at Mizpah. And so we see, even though they were making this decision on their own, they brought the Lord into it. Which reminded me of the Lord's words in Matthew chapter 18, 19 through 20, where Jesus said, "Again, I say to you that if two of you agree on earth about anything that may ask, it shall be done for them by my Father who is in heaven. For where two or three have gathered together in my name, I am there in their midst." And that's exactly what we see going on here. Okay, God didn't appoint Jephthah. These were two groups of people who came and they made an accord together. They brought the Lord in on it, and the Lord honored it. And as we go on and read, we'll see that that God works through Jephthah. Now the Spirit of the Lord came upon Jephthah so that he passed through Gilead and Manasseh. And we read on down, just speeding up here. "So Jephthah crossed over the sons of Ammon to fight against them, and the Lord gave them into his hand. He struck them with a very great slaughter, and 22 cities, and so the sons of Ammon were subdued before the sons of Israel." And so here again, we see two people come together, and they make agreement, they bring the Lord in on this matter, and the Lord honors it. And so that's what I see Jesus talking about in Matthew chapter 18. Look, if two of you guys have an agreement here, and you bring me in on this thing, and it's all holy and honorable, I'm good with it. I'll work with you on it. I'll honor that. And so certainly we can see that kind of stuff taking place for us as well today. Jephthah, though, makes a really foolish thing here, and I'm not going to read all this for time's sake, but basically he makes a promise to the Lord. He says, "Lord, I tell you what, you give me some victory here, I will sacrifice on an altar to you the first thing that comes out my door when I get home." And guess who came walking out? His daughter. A moronic thing for Jephthah to do, if I'm just going to be flat out honest about it. He makes just a stupid, wild thing like this, and he comes home after this great victory, and his daughter has a tambourine in hand, and she's, "Dad, hey!" Jephthah falls apart. But he tells his daughter what he's done, and his daughter has this unbelievable amount of courage. She says, "Look, Dad, you've made this vow to the Lord, then it must be done." She says, "Just give me a couple months to go weep with my friends, and all right." And that's what happens. She goes off for 2 months with her friends, and she comes back, and it happens. Wild and crazy story, but an unbelievably stupid thing that Jephthah did. And what a lesson for us. You know, let's not go making stupid deals with the Lord like this. You know, I hear so many people saying sometimes, "You know, I just made this promise to the Lord that if he would just do it." Don't go entering into stupid kind of agreements with the Lord like that. Not unless you're prepared to follow through. And we can see that Jephthah clearly was. Me, I probably would have just said, "Lord, you can take it out on me. I can't go through with this." But I don't know. That's that. Jephthah, Ismon, Elon, and Abdon. So these are the judges here. After Jephthah judged Israel 6 years, and then he died and was buried. And then we see that these three other judges. That's all we're told about these three guys here. So nothing spectacular, and that's that. You can go read those on your own. I'm going to move on here for time's sake. All right, so next we come to Samson. Probably him and Samuel are probably the two most famous judges we have. Judges 13, verse 1, the sons of Israel again did evil in the sight of the Lord, so the Lord gave them into the hands of the Philistines for 40 years. The angel of the Lord appeared to Samson's parents, and he informed them of Samson's birth. He came to his mother, actually, and said, look, here's what's going to happen. You're going to have a son. Don't be drinking any wine or strong drink, all that kind of stuff. This guy's going to be a Nazarite. His razor shall never touch his head, and all this kind of stuff. Tells his mother all this. And in Judges 13, 24 through 25, the woman gave birth to a son. They named him Samson, and the child grew up, and the Lord blessed him. And the Spirit of the Lord began to stir him in Mahanadan between Zorah and Estel. All right, so then we read on in Judges 14, we see that Samson wanted to marry a woman of the Philistines, which is a big no-no. But and so his parents were saying, son, no. Just pick a woman from amongst the people of Israel. Are there not? Do we not have beautiful women amongst us? And Samson says, I don't care. Go get her for me, for she looks good to me. Again, what's the words of the Bible, not mine. So Samson said, hey, she looks hot. I want to marry this woman. And so Judges 14, verse 4, though, it says that his father and mother did not know that this was from the Lord. For God was seeking an opportunity or an occasion against the Philistines. And now at that time, the Philistines were ruling over Israel. And so through that whole story, he ends up marrying this woman. And there's a whole story tied with it, which I don't have time for. But through this, Samson ended up killing a lot of Philistines. And that was part of his judgment, or God's judgment upon the Philistines there. Working through this situation, he ended up destroying a lot of them. Samson was obviously known for his strength, which we all know to be given to him by the Lord, so long as he maintained his Nazarite vow, which we can read about in Numbers chapter 6. And part of that was never cutting his hair. That was part of the vow. And so we see that that was also a command that was made to Samson's mother when before she even conceived, and that the razor was never to touch his head. But Samson also had a real anger issue. I mean, Samson was not the sharpest guy in the nation of Israel, okay? He was not just the most upstanding and righteous of men. He was a hothead. He had a real anger issue. He had he just had all kinds of problems. But we see the Lord using this, though, to carry out his judgment upon the Philistines. And so basically, anytime the Philistines crossed Samson, a lot of them ended up being killed. This guy just went on killing sprees. And so the Bible would tell us that the Spirit of the Lord would come on him, and he'd go on a killing spree. And so through trickery, the Philistines ultimately learned that Samson would lose his strength if his hair was cut. And it happened. And so the Philistines, they ended up having his hair cut off. He lost all of his strength. They were able to then bind him up, and they tortured him, plucked out his eyes, and I mean, they really gave it to him. And they were making sport of him in this public arena type thing, some massive building, and they had him kind of chained up there in the middle with these two big pillars that were holding up the roof and all. And so he was standing there doing all this stuff. And it was at this time that Samson asked God to restore his strength just one last time so he could avenge himself. And God did. And so Samson pushes these two pillars apart, and the whole thing just comes caving in. It kills Samson, and of course it ends up killing a lot of Philistines as well. And the Bible says that in this event, with the crumbling of this building, that Samson killed more Philistines in this instance here than he had in his whole life. And so a pretty wild story about Samson, really interesting. I challenge you to go read it for yourself. But all this took place over a period of 20 years. So Samson judged Israel for 20 years. The rest of Judges chapter 17 through 21, is an outline of just a tragic period of lawlessness and idolatry that it causes all kinds of problems. And one of the big things that ended up going down was civil war against the tribe of Benjamin. And pretty much that left the tribe just decimated. I mean, just Israel just went to war with itself against Benjamin and absolutely wiped them out. And so in Judges 21, we see Israel mourning this tragedy. You know, they go to war against Benjamin. I mean, just decimate this tribe. And now they're just in mourning over what has gone on. And you know, much how our nation, you know, we've had a civil war and it was an ugly period of time. And certainly there was some mourning that went on of, man, you know, we ought not be going to war with one another and doing this to one another. And so that's what we see going on here in Judges chapter 21. So they're mourning the loss of Benjamin, and they're doing things to try to keep Benjamin alive. You know, they're offering wives to the men who still are alive and things like that to try to keep the tribe of Benjamin in existence, because they decimated them that bad. And then Judges ends Judges chapter 21, verse 25, that in those days there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes. And we see that same thing said several times throughout the passages of chapter 17 through 21. And so we see this just a severe period of lawlessness going on, Israel just falling apart. And that's where we get into 1 Samuel. So Samuel was the last judge. Just very quickly, in 1 Samuel 3, verse 1, we are at the beginning of 1 Samuel. We see his mother says, "Lord, if you'll give me a son," she was barren, "if you'll give me a son, I'll make him yours." And she does. So the Lord blessed her with a son. After the period of his infancy and all that, Samuel's weaned and he's a little boy now and can kind of tend to himself. And Hannah puts him into the temple, working there with Eli and Eli's sons as the priests. And chapter 3, verse 1 says, "The boy Samuel was ministering to the Lord before Eli, and word from the Lord was rare in those days. Visions were infrequent." And so here God begins to speak to Samuel. He comes to Samuel in the middle of the night, and God ends up telling Samuel about how he's going to judge Eli. Eli and his sons were not good priests. They were bad dudes, especially the boys. They were just evil guys. Eli was a ridiculous father in many ways, wasn't tending to his sons. And so God gives Samuel, tells him what he's going to do. 1 Samuel 4, the Philistines and Israel enter battle. The Ark of the Covenant ends up being taken. Eli's sons are killed. When Eli gets news of this, that the Ark was taken, at this time, the Bible tells us that Eli was 98 years old and was a heavy guy. So he was obviously an overweight dude as well. And in, it says that upon hearing about the ark being taken, he fell backwards off his stool and broke his neck and died. And so the judgment there that God told Samuel about was carried out. And Samuel continues on. Samuel chapter 8, verses 4 through 9, if you can just give me a minute or two here. This is the infamous passage where Israel comes and says, "Give us a king." And Samuel, you know, the Lord tells Samuel, "Go ahead and give them one, because they've rejected me as their king." And, you know, so that's why I say that contrast we see at the beginning of Judges, where Joshua dies, they come to their king. They come to God. They have God as their king, and they say, "Lord, what do you want us to do? Who's to go next?" They seek the king. And now here we are at the end of Judges, and they're completely and utterly have rejected God as their king. They've turned to false gods over and over and over, despite God's continuing to work with them and pull them out and bring them out. And now they're saying, "You know what? We still don't want him. Give us a guy. Give us an earthly king." And so God tells Samuel to do so because they've rejected me. And so Samuel does that. Samuel warns us what's going to happen to them. If you have a king over you, he's going to put your sons into war. He's going to take your money. He's going to do this. He's going to take your daughters. Blah, 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 blah. And we saw all that come true as we get into the story of the kings. And so then in 1 Samuel chapter 9 and 10, we see that Samuel meets Saul and he anoints Saul as king over Israel. And so that ends that whole period. And from here on, we'll pick up with the period of the kings at some point in the future. So that's that. Thank you for all your attention these past, I think, 48 classes I've taught in here, I think tonight is. So I think we've learned a lot. I hope it's been beneficial to you all. I know it certainly has been beneficial to me. It's just a refresher of how awesome the Lord is in this story of redemption. So we'll continue this on at a later point in time, though. And Mike, we look forward to having you back here teaching with us, brother.